summer. Summer holidays. Remember that feeling as a kid? If you grew up on the farm or a small town like I did, oh man, summertime could be very boring. You'd be excited to get out of school, and like a week later, it's like, I'm bored. I want to go back to school. I miss my friends. Well, nowadays, of course, kids have got a whole lot more stuff to stimulate their minds and to keep them active and involved. But sometimes it's too much when it comes to screen time. And I think back when I was a kid and our black and white TV and our three channels, and my mom would say, you're not watching TV all summer. Well, of course I wouldn't be watching TV all summer. We only had soap operas and game shows. That was the extent of TV viewing, but it's a very different world nowadays. Are you concerned about the amount of time your youngsters spend on the phone? And especially with summertime, and maybe mom and dad are busy working and the kids have got a lot more free time at home. And does that then turn into screen time? And what do you do about that? We're going to get some advice on this topic from our guest, Dr. Alexandra Gold. Dr. Gold is a licensed clinical psychologist with Massachusetts General Hospital and faculty as well at Harvard Medical School. And we're fortunate enough to get Dr. Gold for a few minutes this morning. Welcome to Saskatchewan, Dr. Gold.
Thanks so much for having me.
So clearly in your role as a psychologist, you see the problems probably every day of young people being addicted to their screens. What in the world are we doing to our young people with these devices?
Challenging, you know, the screen use. I do want to say, I think there's a balance. I think moderation is what's important. You know, there can be some negative effects, and, you know, sometimes, you know, phone use can have positive effects in terms of people finding their communities on social media, people that they might not meet in their day-to-day. You know, having that outlet can be very helpful. At the same time, sometimes social media and phone use can expose young people to some of the negatives, like, you know, comparisons to other people, negative body image. Sometimes people, especially teens, might be on social media instead of getting their nightly sleep requirements. We know that teenagers really do require 8 to 10 hours of sleep each night, and that's because of the cognitive as well as developmental changes that they're undergoing. And when they're using their screen, that affects their sleep because of the blue light that comes out of the screen, and that affects the production of hormones that promote sleepiness.
And of course, we've all heard that.
I'll just say that I think social media can also sometimes prevent real life relationship building because all of it is on the phone.
Well, and as you mentioned, you know, the social media aspect for young people, and we've all heard the stories of bullying online, which often goes so far as to see young people take their lives. And you think about anxiety and depression and messed up sleep. So what, as parents, can we do to reduce the risk for our youngsters?
Yes, very, very tough situation it can be. And so what I would say to parents first, you know, if you don't specifically notice that the phone use is a major problem, but you think, you know, better if they do some things off the phone, I would encourage you to help your teen set up activities this summer that in and of themselves don't involve using a phone. So maybe it's going to a camp or spending a day at the beach or doing some specific activity in which phones are not involved. In that way, you are addressing the phone issue and also exposing teens, hey, to this activity I actually really like. Maybe this is something I would rather do than be on a phone. If you do notice that the phone use is starting to have problems, and by that I mean noticing that your teen is acting differently, maybe they seem more withdrawn, their mood has changed, they have isolated themselves from friends that they used to spend time with, family members, I think that's an opportunity to really have an open, non-judgmental conversation with your teen about the concerns that you have and approach it from the standpoint of mutual conversation and problem solving. How can we work together to set limits around your phone use? Maybe it's blocking a certain app at a certain time or only allowing you to use it for a certain duration.
And of course, we think of the old adage, do as I say, not as I do. Parents also, I'm guessing, would have to be aware that if you're on your phone a whole bunch, then your youngsters are probably going to emulate that behavior and be on the phone a lot as well.
Absolutely. I think that modeling of behavior plays a big role. And, you know, also modeling that problem-solving approach I was mentioning to let's work together to solve this. If you're spending a lot of time on your phone, and maybe I myself as a parent, you know, maybe I could also modify my phone use, let's together problem-solve this. I think that will go a long way to getting your teen on board.
It's crazy, you know, and I'm sure you can relate, but even myself, I get that weekly report on my phone telling you how many hours a day on average, and I sometimes look at the number and I think, no, really? Like, it's just amazing how these devices consume our time.
Absolutely, yes, it is true. You know, it's a big part of our world now is on media, social media, on the phone. And that's where I said, you know, I don't think we need to look at social media and phone use as all good and all bad. Like many things, moderation is key. And I think it's really looking at it as, okay, this is something that maybe is a part of my life, but how can I make sure that I'm not leaving everything else out by using my phone?
And I guess every family is different, too. You know, some families, their youngsters get phones at a very early age. Others try to hold off as long as they can. But when you think about the situation where you have to have this conversation with a youngster, what are your thoughts on what's the best age to have the conversation, or even what's the best age for them to have access to a phone?
I really do think that is a very family-specific and personal decision. I do think that those elements can vary family to family. Every family has their own culture, and there's no one way to do things. I think what is important is, like we were discussing, just being aware of some of these signs that if your teen is on a phone, a lot of kids, a lot of young people are using screens. They're using phones. They're getting access to them in some way. And so I think just making sure that you know, okay, if I notice my teen is acting differently, they don't seem like themselves, they're more withdrawn, they seem more sad or anxious or angry or irritable, they're starting to have problems when it's the school year with their grades, with their schoolwork, they're not getting their homework done, they're isolating themselves. I think being aware of those warning signs is what is probably the most important element of that.
Psychologist Dr. Alexandra Gold is our guest as we're talking about, you know, as we head into summer, your teenagers especially have more free time on their hands, and that time may see them spending more time on their phones. So we're just thinking about ways that you could perhaps help them reduce those hourly numbers. And I think it's a good conversation. Even adults need to have this conversation about how social algorithms work. You know, that it's easy when you pick up the phone and you spend a lot of time doing some scrolling around. All of a sudden you get the sense, hey, everybody is thinking about the same things I am, or everybody's depressed like I am. It'd be a good conversation, wouldn't it, to explain why they see the things they do when they're online.
Absolutely. I think you bring up a really great point, which is a lot of the social media use, when it becomes challenging or not a positive space, it really depends on the quality of what's being seen. And by that, I mean, what algorithm are they receiving? What is being fed to them? Because the problem lies in the quality of the use often, sometimes the quantity of use too, like we're talking about. But what are you seeing? What are you spending time with on social media? And how can we, if you are using social media, think about making sure that you are attending to those elements that help you feel better. And that's a conversation I think parents can have with their teens. Like, hey, when you look at that account or when you look at that type of content, how does that make you feel? How does that affect you? And your teen might be able to talk about, you know, how they feel when they see certain accounts or what goes on for them. And then, you know, maybe you could brainstorm together. Hey, why not, when you're on social media, spend time with this different content, and that could have an effect of updating the algorithm, perhaps.
Yeah. Good idea. You know, some friends of mine did something and I thought it was really cool. They got their kids involved for the summer. They're doing what they call phone fasting. And as a family, they all agree to lay off the phone for a certain amount of time, be it for over the course of a day or a week. And I thought, that's a neat idea, phone fasting.
That is a really great idea. And I also think it really gets to that collaborative piece that we were talking about, of this being a mutual conversation, mutual problem solving, where it doesn't feel like your kid is being told what to do. But hey, we're all on the same page working together to address this, because, yeah, it's good to live life in moderation and spend some time enjoying the summer.
Absolutely. Dr. Alexandra Gold, thanks so much for your time here today.
Thanks for having me.
You bet, Dr. Alexandra Gold. Just a little bit of information there. There's something for parents to be thinking about with the extra time. Your phone access, youngsters, you know, because I could say teenagers, but I know kids younger than teens that have phones as well. Just thinking about ways as a family or as individuals to reduce the amount of screen time that they're putting in over the course of the summer. And I'm telling myself this as well. I'm trying to force myself more and more to not spend time so much, because you do that. It's almost second nature, isn't it? You sit down. Oh, gosh, it's crazy how our lives have changed with these phones. You got the TV on, you're watching something on TV, and then you got your phone in your hand scrolling along. Like, oh, man, no wonder our brains are getting messed up at times. Okay, we got, that's what we want to do. We want to talk real quickly with, we've got an ag reporter standing by here. Kelvin Heppner is going to weigh in. He's with Real Ag as well here in just a couple of minutes about the Bunge Viterra takeover. We'll get to that. Our next segment on the Evan Bray Show on 980 CJME and 650 CKOM.
That's what I said now. Princess, you adore you. Just go.
good summer day out there, Saskatchewan. Right now, Saskatoon 27, Regina 28. Regina is going to heat up to about, what are they saying, 34, 35 degrees this afternoon. And with the heat, possibility of some typical summer afternoon thunderstorms. Nice to see some precipitation if we could get something out of this. I'm wondering how many of our farm folks, how they're feeling about the announcement that came overnight that the acquisition of Viterra, the takeover of Viterra by Bungie, is now complete. And this all got started about 2 years ago when they first announced it, and it's had to go through all these different approvals in different countries, but it's all a go now. So what's that going to mean for farmers? Good news, bad news? Thought we'd get a view on this from Kelvin Heppner. He's on the line from Altona, Manitoba. He's a farmer, and he's an ag journalist with Real Agriculture. Hey, Kelvin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brent.
No problem at all. So from your work in the ag community, what are you seeing and hearing? Is this good, bad, or indifferent for most of our farmers?
Well, there's been a lot of concern about this, about reduced competition and consolidation. University of Saskatchewan report that was commissioned by farm groups from Saskatchewan and Alberta a year or two ago raised a lot of these concerns. The Competition Bureau also raised some concerns, but in the end, the Canadian government approved it earlier this year. And like you said, as of yesterday, the deal is official. Viterra is now part of Bungie. I think a lot of it hinges on Bungie is a minority shareholder in G3, which competes with Viterra in a lot of markets across the countryside and also at port, especially on the West Coast. And so a lot of it hinges on how Bungie implements the firewall that the company is supposed to implement between it and G3, of which it holds an ownership stake. Bungie itself is big into crushing canola and soybeans in Canada. They're the largest crusher or have the most crush facilities in Canada. Viterra, on the other hand, is more so into the grain origination and the logistics, the elevators, running those 60-some elevators across Western Canada. And so there's not direct competition there, but once you put G3 into the picture, that's where a lot of the concerns arise, and we'll have to see how this unfolds. There's a lot of big unanswered questions that we hope to get answers to here in the coming weeks.
They say they got to keep their head office in Regina for 5 years. So that's one aspect of this. Not that that really matters, I guess, for farmers. I guess at the end of the day, what's the bottom line, though, for farmers? I know that U of S study that you talked about earlier, it talked about, what, a $700 million loss to Canadian farmers with this?
Yeah, that's under the assumption that G3 is operated underneath Bungie and that there isn't separate or competition between the Bungie and G3 facilities. So that is supposed to have been protected under the Canadian government's conditions for this deal going ahead, but we'll have to see how that goes ahead. There's certainly going to be some market factors here that the dust needs to settle here. One of the big questions as well is the construction of that canola crush plant that Viterra had proposed to build in Regina. It was supposed to likely have been the world's largest canola crush plant, and we have not seen a lot of new development on that, and I'm curious whether we see confirmation in the coming days of those plans being officially canceled, or if there's still any chance of that going ahead. That certainly would have been great news for demand for domestic processing capacity here, and certainly helped farmers in terms of farm gate prices and demand for this key crop across the prairies.
Kelvin Heppner is our guest, a farmer himself, ag journalist with Real Agriculture. But at the end of the day, there's nothing we as farmers can really do about this as far as doing business. As you say, it's more and more these big multinationals now, fewer and fewer of them. So it becomes pretty limited for farmers as to how they're going to market their products or make use of some of their services.
Yeah, exactly. And part of this is kind of an epilogue or another epilogue in the chapter book of the Saskatchewan Wheat Pool. Mm-hmm. Of course, the Sask Wheat Pool formed Viterra in 2007 when it bought AgriCorps United. Then Glencore and the Canada Pension Plan Investment Board came into the picture with funding. And now, as of today, kind of the transformation from a farmer-run pool to this global company is essentially complete. It's now Bungie. It's now this multinational company. They have 37,000 employees around the world, operations in 50 countries, more than 40 port facilities. So this is a big company now. And in tradition, grain industry tradition, it's a cultural thing to run these companies in a very tight-lipped fashion. And so trying to find some of the nuggets in terms of what this means for our farmers here across the prairies, it's certainly something that we're working hard at and we'll continue working at here in the coming weeks.
Sure. And with, as you say, say, such a massive company, worldwide company, it probably can't turn on a dime anyway, that I would imagine any change would be a little more gradual. But one thing that did catch my eye when I was looking at some of the information this morning, that part of the clearance, the approval process actually had to come out of China. And I guess that speaks to the worldwide spread of what Bungie is all about.
Yeah, exactly. This deal, like you said, was announced back in 2023. It's been over 2 years in the making, and the Canadian approval was one of the big ones. That one came earlier this year, back in January, and they were awaiting Chinese government approval, regulatory approval, and that came a couple weeks ago. And so, yeah, now that was kind of the final hurdle. It is now over the finish line. And like you said, that's also what our sources are saying, that integration has started, but it's going to take some time, and they're still sorting through how this is going to affect field operations. And that's certainly, from a farmer's perspective, I'd encourage all producers, of course, and they know this, to talk to their local elevator reps to figure out what it means for their local contacts and places where they can sell and deliver grain.
Absolutely. Kelvin Heppner, appreciate your insight. We'll talk again. Thanks for your time.
Sounds good. Thank you for having me again.
You bet. Kelvin Heppner, farmer and ag journalist with Real Agriculture, checking in this morning, just talking a little bit about the takeover of Viterra by Bungie, now complete. Big, massive, worldwide company. Impressive to see. As far as the farm community, I'm sure it's probably going to be a bit of a wait and see as well as to how much it's going to impact our individual farmers here in Western Canada. Anything you might have to think on that, we'd love to hear from you on our text line, 1-877-332-TALK, 1-877-332-8255. Coming up here, we're going to the dogs. Coming up here after 11:30 this morning, Conrad Keller is going to join me. He is a head trainer with Sunshine Service Dogs. I don't know if he's bringing a dog in studio or not, but it'd be kind of cool to see. But he brings an interesting topic to the Evan Bray Show today. There is no specific legislation in place for service dogs. I'm going to dig into that with Conrad Keller. Like, I'm thinking, you mean I could order like a service dog vest for my animal off Amazon, throw it on him, and then go about my duties around the city or around the province and go into a business and say, oh, no, this is a service dog. But he thinks we got to do something as far as some sort of regulation on that. And he's also here to answer any questions you might have. If you got a problem dog, he's going to be here till noon. We'll get going just after the news here in just a moment. You got a dog query, you can text it if you like, or you can call 1-877-332-8255. Happy to be with you on this sunny Thursday. Brent Laux filling in on the Evan Bray Show on 980 CJME and 650 CKOM. Tell you, this show's gone to the dogs. Good morning, it's Brent Laux filling in on the Evan Bray Show here today. We are talking about service dogs right now, and I'm joined in studio by Conrad Keller. Conrad is the head trainer and founder of Sunshine Service Dogs in Saskatoon, and it's interesting because I'm just having a chat here with Conrad about service dogs, the work they do, why people would want to have a service dog, but also some areas about service dogs, a little unusual in my mind, here in Saskatchewan. Hey, Conrad, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So with the situation, could I get you just a little closer to that microphone there? So what is the situation right now in Saskatchewan as far as, I guess we could say, service dog regulations?
So there's lots of protections for service dogs in Saskatchewan for their handlers and themselves. So service dogs have public access, so that means they're able to go anywhere a human can in Saskatchewan. So there's lots of those protections in Saskatchewan. However, there's really no regulations when it comes to actual training of that service dog.
Really?
So it can be very kind of confusing for people to understand this process.
So as it stands right now, I could go on Amazon and find a service dog vest and throw it on my old chocolate lab and go walking into my favorite restaurant and I'd say, hey, it's a service dog, gotta let me in.
Pretty much, yeah.
Really?
And that's just not okay. It tends to make legitimate service dogs look illegitimate, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. So why is that? Are there provinces regulated differently?
Yeah, most provinces have a very specific program about how the dogs are trained, how many years, how their health, all that kind of stuff. So it's all organized well. I tend to follow the government of Alberta standards. So they tend to provide very clear details what the expectations are. And then usually at year two, so it's 2 years of time, mm-hmm. they tend to will have to pass a public access test. So that's what I have my dogs do. But in Saskatchewan, there's really nothing to say that a dog is a service dog in training or a service dog or anything in general. So.
That's odd. That's
yes, very much
strikes me. Yeah. Although now I can hear a lot of people saying, I might want to get one of these for my dog. Mm. So what do most people come to you for when they say, I need a service dog, I want to try a service dog to help me? What is the most common condition that these people are dealing with?
Well, my expertise is in psychiatric service dogs. So we go a very common one, or I don't like using the word popular, but something that the media has covered lots is PTSD.
Right.
Military and police is a very common type of mental illness, and that's where they mm-hmm. kind of work with. But, depression, anxiety is also, kind of those common ones. We have pups who can work with people with bipolar, mm-hmm. All that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of mental illness that a dog could offer support with. It's not for everybody, but it's certainly a benefit.
How do people apply then? Do they come to you and say, I want to have you train a dog for me so it'll be my service dog? Is that how the process works?
Well, kind of. We have a three interview process that I go through. I need to, talk to their mental health professionals have a letter from them saying that, this is something they'd benefit from. A service dog would be useful. And we go through a big, long process that basically shows me what I need to look for a puppy. Mm-hmm. So I start my service dog puppies at 8 weeks old. They're already chosen before then, that are kind of be the most benefit for that person. And we kind of custom fit the dog to the person. That's kind of the best way I can do it. Mm-hmm. It's like I said, about a 2 year process to get them into a fully trained service dog.
2 years. Mm-hmm. So do I have to wait that long, or do you have some dogs in training already that I could say, hey, I'll take that guy if he's wrapping up his training here?
Well, right now, like I said, the dog's kind of custom trained to you,
yeah.
or custom
sure.
organized to you. So once we get or find that specific puppy that will kind of fit your needs, that's when we will start the training process. The nice part is you are part of the training process.
Oh, I
from
see.
The get-go.
Okay. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So you get to know and love. That's kind of a big one with service dogs, is we need to know that that dog is going to bond with you. You're going to bond to them. That's how a dog is going to kind of read your personality and your needs the most.
Conrad Keller is my guest, head trainer and founder of Sunshine Service Dogs. The main thing we were mentioning with Conrad was the fact that in Saskatchewan, you don't have to have any proof or registration that your service animal has been trained in any way. You can just, because under the Human Rights Code, you're able to have your animal along with you, I guess, anywhere you go, a restaurant,
yep.
an office or anything like that, if you're able to say it's a service dog, and there's no kind of special identification they have to show?
I mean, really, no. Like, the funny thing is you can get a vest with service dog or service dog in training put on it from Amazon for $20, and mm-hmm. you can put it on there and go to town if you want. But,
okay. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit more about the training process then. Mm-hmm. So I'm somebody who's suffering from PTSD. I've been toying with the idea of having a service dog. You say it's about a 2 year training window that we're looking at, but mm-hmm. I'm engaged with the dog. So are we basically, does the dog live with me for that 2 years, or does he stay with you?
So actually we have puppy raisers, wonderful volunteer puppy raisers that we place them with right at 8 weeks when they're ready to go, go, and they stay with the puppy raiser for about a year. So they're, of course, the handler has, time to spend with them and stuff like that.
Sure.
But for the most part, they're being trained with myself and the puppy raiser just to get them, kind of in those really good learning years, we really want to them to understand kind of the world and get them very comfortable with everything in life, and teach them some of these tasks that we need that the dog's able to do. And then after that year time, that's when we'll actually put them in your home and bring them and get you working more with them. So that'll be kind of like your full-time, your dog. That's where I will, we do training classes and outings and everything with you every, pretty much three or four times a week.
That's nice.
Get them out and build your trust and your bond with them as well.
Have you got success stories, people that have made use of one of these dogs and that it's changed their lives?
It sure has. Yeah. So I have my oldest boy, his name is Trip. He's, along his way with his mom, and she's seen a huge benefit. Right now, I believe are they in Manitoba right now? They're just traveling. They're enjoying their life. Trip has made a huge difference in her life.
That's nice.
Be able to feel more comfortable with herself and the world in general.
Any particular breed of dog that works better as a service dog?
Well, for me, I use English Labs. So those are more specifically. They're kind of
the shorter, stockier Labs.
Yes, sir. So they're more laid back, a little friendly. I call them, they're more. Socially driven and or handler driven.
So
they're more interested in you. They still love their food, don't get me wrong. But they
sounds like my lab.
That's right. But they still love their people. But no, any dog, I shouldn't say any dog, but there's some genetic factors that can make things harder. But a lot of times, I've seen heelers, I've seen border collies, I've seen mutts, of course, that can do their service work wonderfully. It just depends on their handler and what their needs are, right? So that's my biggest thing.
It's interesting. We just had a text come in from one of our listeners, kind of along the line of what we were talking about. This person says, when we travel, we find hotels generally charge $25 to $40 to have our dog in our room at night. That's why our pooch is occasionally a service dog.
Yeah. I don't condone that behavior. Sorry.
Hey, whatever it takes, I guess, so people are thinking here. Conrad Keller, head trainer, founder of Sunshine Service Dogs. So when we think about the idea in Saskatchewan, then there is no kind of certification required or proof required that my dog is indeed a service dog. Are you trying to get that changed?
I'd like that too. Yeah, honestly, I would love to see some more regulations. I think that just it'll benefit everybody. It makes legitimate service dogs be more legitimate to the public eye. I mean, I'll be honest, most places in the city and in the province have been fantastic with service dogs. They don't ask, they're not concerned about it. But, it certainly delegitimizes our process when we have a dog who is not a service dog have a vest on and is dragging their owner around, barking, reacting. Yeah. It causes a lot of distrust.
Well, it's a bad image, too.
It's a very bad image.
Somebody sees a dog that isn't properly trained and it's got a service vest on, they're thinking, what's this all about?
Exactly. So.
Well, it's interesting. Can you stick around for a few more minutes,
sure,
Conrad? Excellent. If you got any questions for Conrad, we'd love to hear from you. You can call or phone at 1-877-332-TALK, 1-877-332-8255. We'll take a break and we'll be back with more of the Evan Bray Show on CKOM and CJME. My guest this half hour is Conrad Keller. Conrad is the head trainer and founder of Sunshine Service Dogs in Saskatoon. And what brought Conrad in was basically his thought that Saskatchewan needs to do more as far as regulations as it pertains to what a service dog is, how they're trained, and some proof of identity, I guess, because right now, as Conrad was saying, you could go on Amazon and buy the vest says service dog and put it on your animal, which really defeats the purpose of what this is about, and it really discredits the whole service dog program, doesn't it, when people do this?
Absolutely.
We had a text in as well from Shirley in Melfort. Says, do you take your dogs through the St. John's therapy dog test?
Actually, therapy dogs are a lot different than service dogs.
Really? Could you explain that? I didn't realize that. Yeah. So you have service dogs, what you work with, and then they're therapy dogs.
Yeah. So therapy dogs are more dogs that are for, going out to hospitals, a good example, or
care homes?
Care homes, that's a good one, exactly. Yeah. They don't have public access. They are not, don't have that kind of training. They don't provide a service to a person.
Gotcha.
They're more for love and affection and attention kind of thing. Whereas service dogs, they have a very specific way. They're usually handled by one person their entire lives, their handler. They're trained to that handler's needs and requirements, and it's a lot bigger, a lot longer of a process. For sure.
So therapy dogs and then service dogs. Any other category here that we're missing?
There's emotional support dogs and stuff like that, but again, those are more of a they don't have public access. There's no rules or regulations for emotional support dogs. You can deem any dog an emotional support dog, but they don't have that public access like a service dog does. Mm-hmm. So
are you seeing more demand, more people wanting, you know, and people especially, you said you focus on psychological issues for people, PTSD and depression and such. Mm-hmm. Is there more and more people saying, I like the idea, I'd like to have a service dog?
It's always been a very popular, type of treatment, I guess, mm-hmm. for people or, something that that helps them. I think it's a little bit more of a... an interest, but when things start to get around to it, there's a lot of work behind it.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of money behind it. So that's why, you know, with Sunshine Service Dogs, I try to remove that financial barrier with the charity. We rely on public funds to get that, those dogs, because they can cost $25,000, $30,000.
And you do this on your own as a charity.
Yes, sir.
Good for you. And you also have a business. You have the Hound Lounge in Saskatoon, the doggy daycare.
Exactly.
Good for you.
Yeah.
We've got a listener, Elaine, on the line, who's patiently hanging in there from Prince Albert. Elaine, you've got a question?
Well, kind of a question, not really. Accreditation. I was in a head-on collision with a drunk driver, so I have a very large black German Shepherd. That's my service dog, because I've been left with some issues. Mm-hmm. In Saskatchewan, I've only been asked twice for proof, mm-hmm. and I carry a letter from my doctor, but I do travel a fair amount. And every single time I've gone to Alberta, I am asked in every place that I go into. And my last trip going through Lethbridge at the Super 8, they required her pedigree, her vet certificate, and my doctor's letter. Not only did they look at it, they took copies of it and kept it, which I was really upset about. And I just don't agree with this at all. Mm-hmm. I can see them having to see it, mm-hmm. but to make copies and keep it, huge invasion of my rights.
Yes,
and my rights to even be asked.
Yep.
Did they charge you more for having your service dog in your hotel?
They wanted to, and then I really kicked up a fuss, and they caved on that point, and I don't know why, because the room they gave me was absolutely filthy, and my dog is, like, would never go in the house, like, she wouldn't. So, just very upset that, yeah, it should be right across Canada, the same rules and regulations for all of us, and yeah, if I got to show proof, that's why I got letters from the vet and my doctor, and carry her pedigree. I carry them all with me all the time.
Good for you, Elaine. Cutting off that problem, hopefully, before it exists at the next place you go to. Thanks so much for the call and the comments. So, the interesting situation for Elaine there.
Yeah, that's certainly very inappropriate behavior for that, especially in Alberta. Alberta obviously has regulations. I actually follow their regulations to their service dogs in my program, but they still need to understand that. The dog is from Saskatchewan, a very different profile.
Yeah.
So they can't really ask for these things. I always try to remind the public that a service dog is a piece of medical equipment. Mm-hmm. That's all it's to be treated. So if you are going to ask someone in a wheelchair for the proof that you're disabled, which if you're not going to, then you should never ask a service dog handler that as well. And you don't have, nowhere in Canada do you have to give them any proof that you're disabled to have the service dog. Now your dog can have a certification from your government saying, like Alberta does, that they are an approved service dog. That's all you should have to give to. You should never have to provide personal details about your disability in order to access public anything.
Well, this falls under the human rights code. This is what this is all about. Mm-hmm. That if you're able to, go into a business and bring your service dog under the human rights code, they basically can't refuse you, can they?
I mean, they can question in a very specific detail. So if the dog is acting inappropriate, then yes, they are free to. But no, they should never be able to allow you to ask, or should never ask you to, and never accept it as a question, why you're disabled, what you need the dog for, anything like that. You have no duty to disclose any of this.
Conrad, I appreciate you coming in today. We're running out of time here, but what's next in your efforts to try to get a better understanding at the provincial level here as far as registration or confirmation of a service dog?
You know what? Just getting the information out there that it, how inappropriate this is, and how more these requirements should be part of it.
Have you talked to anybody in the government about it?
This is the first time I've actually talked to the public.
There you go. Breaking ground right here.
That's right.
Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
The Evan Bray Show. Brent Lugs filling in today on 980 CJME and 650 CKOM.